We're gonna go straight into it. So we're on episode 3 now. Thanks again for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. Today we got with us, we got Rashad. You mind telling the people a little bit about yourself, like where are you from, what are you currently doing at Iowa State?
Yeah, so I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, born and raised. I went to Linmar High School, which is kind of like in a suburb area of Cedar Rapids. And then I study economics at Iowa State. And then I'll be working on a master's degree in applied economics. That's what I'll be studying in grad school. So.
And you're doing your master's here at Iowa State?
No, so it'll most likely be at University of Houston. They don't have a applied economics program at Iowa State. They just have like pure economics.
Okay. What led you to economics in particular, or applied economics?
Yeah, so it'll kind of lead into like the kind of path where I started working in politics. But I noticed that in terms of like economic policy and economic literacy, as far as like the communities that like I was serving, there was a lot of like misleading information or misinformation, and a lot of like work to be done as far as how to best serve like the people. And so a major in economics gives you a lot of background as far as like you really know how the work that you're doing is going to benefit not just you and not just the company you work for, but the community around it. And so that's kind of why I wanted to study economics. And then applied economics is just basically taking economic principles and applying them in like a business setting. It's a kind of like a framework for data analysis is really what it is. So that's what I want to study in grad school.
What were you like kind of like in childhood? Was this like something you dreamt about as a kid, or like were there any experiences that kind of shaped you to go this route?
Yeah, no, as a kid, it's very far from what I thought I'd be doing. I either thought I'd be
when you were a kid.
Yeah, no, like other than like this typical like, oh, I want to be an athlete, I want to play in the NBA. Like I wanted to be an engineer for sure, or a lawyer. A lawyer was more because it was always told to me like, you need to be a lawyer. Like you argue way too well. But like it was never like a I see myself as a lawyer kind of thing. Like really saw myself as an engineer. And then I started as a chemical engineering student at Iowa State. And I was doing fairly well, but it's just not something that like, before I had the information that I currently have now, I felt as though I was going to be kind of pigeonholed into engineering if I was an engineering student. And that my interests are so broad. Like, I love working on different projects in different sectors and being able to pick up different information and kind of learn on the go. And I thought at the time, like as a freshman, you're 19 years old, you're a little bit immature. Like I thought I was going to be pigeonholed into being a chemical engineer, which I was working at an like a research position to the Department of Energy, working on solar panels. And I thought like that was just going to be what I was going to do, and I was going to be working on renewable energy for the rest of my life. And so when I stepped away to work in politics, I got more into like economic policy, and that's what spurred me to like change my major there.
When did you first kind of get that idea of getting involved? Like, when did you first hear about that? Like, did you know that was something you could do prior to coming to college, or was this something like you just experienced or found out about while you were in college?
The politics?
Yeah.
So really what it was is there was a guy in my hometown who was running to be the first Black congressman in Iowa. We've never had a congressional member from Iowa that's an African American. We've never even had somebody win the primary of their party as an African-American, as far as I can remember. So he was running out of my hometown in the first congressional district. And it was an opportunity for me to, so kind of a little bit of like family background as to why like local politics matter so much. Is my mom's a teacher. Obviously teachers are so directly affected by legislation. The entire school budgets come from legislation. Like all of the work that they do is directly affected by how people vote and who's elected in office. My dad is the vice president of the Union at Quaker Oats. And so there's a huge party gap and difference in the beliefs and in the power of unions. And so elected officials also like have a huge impact on my father's work and kind of the rights and the limitations of unions. and just kind of the atmosphere in general as far as the union business relationship, as far as like their ability, their collective bargaining ability and stuff like that. And so I thought it was a really good opportunity for me to kind of do something positive for the people that I care about. And it was just really going to take place over the summer. And then I started really enjoying it. The campaign started going really well, so I extended it out. And then when he lost during the primary, I ended up getting a job offer from the Democratic candidate for governor. So I was working originally for George Ramsey, Fred Hubble's campaign saw all the work that I was doing. They asked me for to work for them until the end of the gubernatorial election. So it wasn't anything that I knew about, had any thought of, planned on. It was just like, oh, this is a great opportunity for me. I'm going to jump at it. And that's kind of like the theme of my life is like, wow, this seems like a really great opportunity. I can kind of, I see how this both is going to make me feel good about the work that I'm doing. And it's also a great professional opportunity for me. Like, I'm just going to go, like, I'm just going to do it. And then like, I can plan and like strategize about how that's going to help me or how I'm going to like make up for whatever afterwards. But I can't like let this opportunity pass. It's just going to be better.
Definitely. You got to hop on your opportunities while you have them. So it sounded like, you know, just heard about it and you're just like, I got to get on this. How'd you get that point to where you got to the point of progressing from just doing it locally to even working with on the Bernie Sanders campaign?
Yeah, so I
think getting to that point.
I think it was a matter of understanding, like, throughout each campaign, I've had a different role. In the first campaign, because it was a small campaign, we had like three people working on the campaign, maybe four. I did everything. Like, we were all doing everything. Whether I was like coming up with op-eds and sending out written submissions to the newspapers and contacting with local news organizations to get them some camera time, or going out to the Iowa Veterans Home and meeting with the veterans and sitting down with the director of the Veterans Home and talking about our plans as far as what the candidate wants to bring to him, because there was something that was going to be privatized, and that would kind of bring a lot of issues for them. So like originally I was kind of all encompassing, and then in that I transferred over to the Hubble campaign where I was like really front facing, where I was just doing a lot of voter interaction, talking to voters. And I knew that if I wanted to continue in campaigns, I really had to find my niche. And I realized that the bigger campaigns, there's a lot of analysis. There's a lot of statistical analysis, and that's something that I feel I was fairly good at. And so that's kind of the route that I decided to pursue. And so in between the Hubble campaign and the Sanders campaign, I really focused a lot on like how I can help in like the data analysis portion of the campaign, because that's something that will forever be a part of political campaigns moving forward. You can't have a campaign without like a solid data structure.
When you talk about a statistical analysis, what type of data are you looking at for these like voters or whatever it is type of data you might be looking at? What typically do you see in your data? Like what type of information is it?
Yeah, so it's really two-sided. Obviously there is like, as any campaign, you have to do some sort of tracking. Where are we now as far as our support? Where do we think we'll be as far as our support, and how do we get from point A to point B? So it's a lot of projections measuring. It's a lot of, okay, we know that our base is this percent of the electorate. We know that this percent of the population we think we can persuade to be a part of our, like, support our campaign. And then there's this percent of the population that just isn't going to support us. And it's a matter of measuring county by county, like what do we need to do to win each county in order to become the Democratic candidate? But then there's also another side where a lot of political organizing is that it's literally just that, it's organizing, it's getting people to draw out people. And so a big project that I was working on is it's a tiering system for based on this person's demographics and the things that they've done in the past and what we know about them as a voter. What's the likelihood that they'll volunteer for us or support us or donate to us? Because it's a way of organizing our time. We don't have enough time to call everybody in Iowa every single day. So we need to prioritize time to find who's going to be the most effective people for our organizers to call. So it's essentially just a volunteer tiering list in order to like prioritize. These are the people that we need to talk to every single day. These are the people that if we talk to them every once in a while, there's a chance they may hop on. But if we can get this core group of people, then we'll have really good success. And in Iowa, I think like the Sanders campaign had by far the biggest volunteer base. And it's in part to some really good data by like my team, like my coworkers and my boss were just brilliant, brilliant people, and then some really good work by some organizers. But it's a matter of like really strategizing how every single minute is going to be spent, because campaigns are like ever changing. They're constantly changing. One day some person's in the head in the polls by 3%, and then all your fans go crazy and they're like really worried. And then another minute you're up 10%, and they're like, oh, we got this, like we're chilling. You're like, no, we don't. I promise you, it's not that easy. Like, the poll can have us up by 25%, that doesn't mean we're gonna win. Please still continue to like volunteer. And so it's a really crazy, like tumultuous but like really satisfying field of work. But
would you mind if we continued the rest of the interview without the video, because mine's starting to lag a lot more?
Yeah whatever you want to do, man.
My next question was going to be, so you come from, well, you did, you originally started doing, when you came to Iowa State, you originally started in engineering, and then you ended up switching to economics. Mm-hmm. And now when you're talking about what you're, it almost sounds like statistics are like with a mix of data science type role. Mm-hmm. How did you acquire the skills you needed for that type of job, and where did you kind of learn that? Because that's very different from what your typical background is.
No, for sure. I think traditional economics is a really interesting field to study, because you get a great mix of computational and theoretical like aspects. Like there's some really hard like mathematics that goes into economic study, but a lot of it is conceptual. And so it was a nice way to kind of ease into what I would end up be doing. It was just a way to like kind of understand the economic concepts. But then the data science and like the statistical study stuff, I think that was more like personal, like outside of school learning. So doing a lot of courses on Coursera or just like any like free courses that I could find on statistics or data science or like SQL or whatever skills that I would need in my career and in my to further my education. It was just like a matter of finding time to do it on my own. So like I'm constantly signed up for Coursera courses. I'm constantly like trying to expand like my knowledge, because you can only do so much in a semester, and they only offer so much in a semester. And like I can knock out a Coursera class in like a month, and like it's so beneficial for my career. I had to learn SQL like on the fly during my job for the Bernie Sanders campaign, and literally without like free education like sources like Coursera, I never would have been able to do it. I had to like learn and understand like insanely complex stuff. And not because I was writing the code, but because I was like in tandem with somebody who was our like software engineer. Like he was an insanely good coder. And I would just basically give him the framework of how like I thought the model should go, and then he would write it, and I would just like need to know how it works. But yeah, it's all about like personal development, especially if you want to like grow faster than you should be growing in anything. You can't just do what is typical. If you want to grow faster than the people around you, if you want to grow faster than the traditional trajectory of someone in your shoes, you have to do more. You have to do stuff outside of what you're supposed to do. And so that was kind of the approach that I took with it.
Now, how many hours a week would you say you were kind of spending on this? And again, like you said you were also taking not just the Coursera classes, but you were also a student at the time, right?
Yeah. I think it was really just a measure of how well I was balancing the other things. I was never in a situation where like I was going to put in jeopardy the things that were like paramount. Like my education like is paramount. Like my ability to do well in class is number one, and my other endeavors like are important to me. But it was a matter of balancing like, okay, like this week I have a lot of free time. this week I don't have as much homework to do. I'm gonna give this 2 or 3 hours a day, and like after I get done with class, after I go to work, like I'm gonna come back and I'm really just gonna sit down and work on this SQL. I'm really gonna work on this analysis like structure. And then when I was not like in the time that I was working on the campaign when I was early in school, there's a period of overlap, but then a lot of the campaign took place over like winter break, and then I started class late this semester because of the timing of the caucus. But during that period in time, I was giving it 4 or 5 hours a day outside of like work, outside of me actually being at work. I would come home after work, and in my own free time, I'd be like, okay, this is what I'm needing to do at work. This is what my job is requiring of me. I don't know how to do it yet. Let's like learn it before I go back tomorrow. Was kind of the way that I looked at it. And it's tough. It's super tough. Like there is no work-life balance when you're trying to do that sometimes. Like you find a way, like you give yourself an hour here, an hour there, or you take a long lunch break some days to like give yourself some like time to clear your mind or time to like feel as though like you're doing okay. But then you just hit it head on, like you just go.
Now, with you like taking these online classes and learning literally for free, has it changed your view of universities and colleges and just your view of a college degree overall?
Yes and no. I think there's got to be a better way to structure higher education. And I think it's that way with pretty much everything we do. Like, there's got to be a better way to structure the average working day. There's got to be a better way to structure our education. There's got to be a better way to structure like how we get food and our nutrition. Like everything, there's got to be a better way. But I understand why it is structured the way it was based on the knowledge that they had at the time. But yeah, like there's no reason that the requirement is for people to learn one specific way at one specific time during specific hours, regardless of like how they are as individuals, because especially for like a lot of the degrees that people are going to be getting in the future, there's going to be a lot of remote work. There's going to be a lot of work from home. There's going to be a lot of work at your own, like working in your own environment. And I think learning in your own environment is actually a good test for that, because when you have the pressure of you have to come to class, otherwise you don't get the points, or you have to come to class, otherwise you're in a class, if you're in a class of like 20 kids, like your professor's gonna know you're slacking. It doesn't give you the real sense of what it's like to have a, like a work from home environment where it's literally your entire self-motivation that causes you to get up or not. Like there's no pressures of if you're working on a project from home and you don't have to call anybody to let them know you're working on it, it's up to you whether or not you actually do it. And so like I think that's why like self-learning and self-motivated learning has better outcomes than people who like are just forced to go to college because their parents tell them to, and then they get there and they don't really want to do it, and then they don't go to class. So I think it was really an eye-opener as far as the impact that self-motivation has, and the purpose behind why you're doing something is like the biggest determinant in what you actually like accomplish. It's not how smart you are. It's not how hard you work, because you could be a hard worker in high school because you really care, and then you get to college, you don't really be there. All that motivation, a lot of the times, is going to be gone. So self-motivation is like the biggest thing that I learned. And if there's a way for them to kind of implement that in the education process as far as college, like they'll see 10 times better results if they get kids to really want to do studying.
Yeah, having that why is probably, I think, the biggest determinant of like for your success, regardless of what you're doing. But like when it comes to school, it's just the culture in the US has almost kind of shaped it to be like, are you going to be a college student or are you going to be a failure? There's just a stigma that if folks don't go to college, it's not seen as successful. But at the same time, it's you're starting to see new things come up like trade schools for software engineering or data science, where you could work for I think it's like 9 months doing just software engineering strictly, and it's a fraction of the price you'd pay for going to university. At the same time, you're eligible for those same jobs, and it's starting to show up, and it's making a slight difference. And some of these courses are like strictly online, and you could literally same thing. It's having that intrinsic motivation to kind of pursue them. But it's I was just kind of curious to see where you kind of thought about that general shift in regards to, is the college degree still going to hold its value as we have more and more trade schools throughout the nation?
Yeah, so like I think obviously that's super based on what you're studying. I think there's certain things where you need to be in a room surrounded by other people having conversations in order to get like the full value. And I think a lot of that is like majors that are based on like thought and theory. Like it'd be really hard to be an online philosophy major, right? Like the idea of philosophy is like that dialogue between you and the rest of the people and like the way that you frame arguments and your thoughts. And like that'd be a really hard major to have like through an online degree. But like things that are like skills that you can acquire, like software engineering is like an amazing one. You can absolutely and should absolutely pursue software engineering or software like careers in whatever is going to make the most sense for you. And if you know you want to be a software engineer and there's a trade school that's going to teach you a trade and you're not going to need a degree. And the truth is, if you learn software now, you'll be able to do software for like the rest of your life. It's going to be around for that long. So going to trade school and learning it, and it is such a great option, and I would recommend it to like a lot. Like if my kids want to get into software, I think I would probably recommend them going to a trade school or going to like a boot camp or something like that rather than getting a degree on it, because I think it just gives you a bit of flexibility and you really just learn it for 9 months. Like anytime you spend 9 months learning one thing, like you may learn like portions. I don't know exactly how the software engineering curriculum is structured, but your first 2 years, your attention is diverted into other things just because of the way that liberal arts colleges work. Like you have to have your humanities, you have to have your US diversity, like all these other requirements. You're not going to be required to learn that in trade school.
Oh yeah, well, definitely. They kind of structure it in a matter of like where it's almost 30 or 40 hours a week. You're strictly just doing nothing, but it's pretty much it turns into a full-time job of just doing 40 hours a week, just straight software engineering or just like with this data, whatever it is. But I'm the exact same way when it comes to that. Like if you're doing a hard skill like that, yes, for sure. But yeah, when you're completely right when it comes to those type of majors where you can't really, it's not the same if it's online. It really isn't. You can't get the same structure for it. Out of curiosity, I was going to ask you if on my bad, me to cut you off, what were you just going to
No, you're good, man. Go ahead.
I was going to say, out of curiosity, if Bernie was still in the race, what would you still be kind of doing the same thing you were doing of doing classes and working on the side?
Yeah, so it's a little bit different because the way it's structured is I turned down the opportunity to go to another state to work for the campaign because I was in school. Because campaigns are so time focused, he really wouldn't be working back in Iowa until the summer, just because of the way like the caucuses in other states are like structured. Like if he was still in the race right now, he'd be caucusing in other states, and then if he had won the nomination, then he'd be back in Iowa like working on his campaign base here. So I don't think it would have like had too much overlap. Maybe like right now I'd be doing some like small projects for them. But it really would have been just me like fully immersing myself once this semester ends, which they would wait another month. And realistically, like I have the opportunity. They want me to do some data. The way it works is now that we have one nominee for the Democratic Party, the Democratic National Convention is taking over a lot of the campaign. And so they're reaching out to people that worked for the specific campaigns and that did good work to come back and work for the DNC and to work for Biden during the general election. So I still have the opportunity to kind of do a lot of the same work that I was doing. It's just a matter of in what capacity they want me to work and whether or not it fits kind of where I see myself being.
Would you be comfortable sharing the offer details?
Yeah, so there isn't a like final offer yet, but basically what I'd be doing similar work. It'd be a lot in like projection, because I think the best work that we did on my campaign is towards the end of the caucus. We were like within 1% of predicting the outcome based on individual precincts. The way it works is like each precinct has a value. That precinct's value goes into the county value. That county value goes into the state value, and you get a state delegate equivalence at the end. And then those state delegate equivalents go into the national equivalents, which if there was a Democratic convention, those equivalents are like what really matter. And we were like within 1%, and that's including all the error that went on. So like we did a really, really good job of like predicting kind of what we thought the outcome might be. So that's where I'd be working again, but in what capacity again, we aren't sure. It's still really early. He just won the nomination. So the DNC is still in the process of like taking over his campaign and sending out offers, but I know some of the political directors for Biden, and so we're just trying to figure out like what the capacity would be.
So as of right now, you're finishing up your school. You're going to get your master's after this.
Yep.
What goal are you kind of working towards, and where are you kind of at now on like in regards to that journey?
Yeah. So I think. Obviously, I think the main thing is just kind of finishing out my degree. And then after I finish grad school, I think it's kind of tough because I have a pretty tough decision to make as far as what direction I want to go as far as my career. I think I have a plethora of options if I want to stay in politics and work in politics. I think a big part of me, like, is really, really intrigued by the private sector. And there's a lot of options that I'm kind of exploring as far as the private sector as well. And I think there's a nice little like overlap as far as working public and private sector that is like public sector consulting. So like you work for a consulting firm that normally works in private ventures, but then they almost always have a public sector like portion of their team that like helps with like government implementation, or they run analytics for government entities and stuff like that. And I think that's like a really good space for me to be in, because it gives me the flexibility. Like I said earlier, like I love working on new projects all the time. I love like constantly having to develop like new skills and retain new information for like new projects. It just keeps it interesting. So I think that's kind of like a good niche for me. So it's really just a matter of like honing my skills and building up my resume to be able to like look attractive to a company like that.
What does the? Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just kind of wrapping up the sentence.
Yeah, I was gonna say. So, what does success mean to you?
I've always measured success on the impact that you have on people. I think, of course, like just the way that our economy is structured, like financial success is important if you want to talk about like your lineage and like setting up your family in the future to like have as little stress as possible. And that's of course super important to me. Like I grew up with a single mom. I know how much like financial access it like can affect you. But I also know that if I don't have a ton of money for the rest of my life and I help a million people, like there's nothing that can replace like the impact that I've had on those million people. So I think really it's just doing meaningful work, doing it well. And then like, whether it's known or not, how much you had an impact on those people, like it's tangible. So like in my work, working in data, nobody can ever know your name really. Like the biggest data people on the biggest campaigns are unknown except for in their circles, because data is just such a like, anonymous thing. You don't want people like understand or know your data, and so in order to do that, you don't want people to understand or know your data directors. Like it's just kind of an intrinsic part of the job, but their work is so impactful, and the work that they do helps so many people, assuming that the right candidate is elected. And so I think that's really success to me. If I made $1 million and helped one person, I would feel kind of crappy about myself. If I made $1 and helped 1 million people, I'd be okay.
Wow, that was amazing. What resources or like support systems are you utilizing to help yourself reach that success?
Yeah, I think it's, as I've gotten older, I've met people that have accomplished, not necessarily in the same paths, but have taken like had big structural changes in their life, and it's led them to bigger accomplishments later on. And I think it's just using those people as a framework, like, hey, like, in the process, like, how did you learn all the information on the fly in order to go from this to this? Or what was it like to have to completely rebuild your knowledge base in order to do a completely different job than what you were doing before? My mom, it's amazing. My mom's such a great example. She was in college after I was born. So like she went from not having a college degree to she's about to finish her master's degree. She works in special education. And she's like one of like the lead special education teachers in her district. And like that happened as she was a single mom. Like the amount of like, we were talking about like your self-motivation and your drive to do something. Like I couldn't imagine being in school, working and having a kid like as a single parent. Like that's absurd to me. So just using her as a reference, using the gentleman I worked for, George Ramsey, as a reference. He was military for 31 years and then retired. And then after his retirement was like, I'm not done helping. I want to like go into public service. And so he ran for office. Just using people like that as references. I have a great support system. My girlfriend's amazing. My family is amazing. They're all so helpful. And so just kind of like piggybacking off of them as far as like support and stuff like that as well.
What is the best piece of advice you got, whether it's from your own mom or just mentors?
Yeah, I think it's to enjoy the result of the work you do, but also like enjoy the work itself. My mom, that's like one of the things that I admire about her the most and something that we talk about a lot, is her job couldn't be more stressful. Like she was at a school where teachers were like getting assaulted by kids, where like it's kids with like severe like behavioral disabilities. Like one teacher got hit in the eye and had to have surgery, and like they would just like come back to school like happy to see the kids the next day. I'm like, how is that even possible? Like she was like, I couldn't imagine doing anything else. I love my work. So like as much as like, yes, I do the work because it's helping these kids, I couldn't do anything else. Like this is what I'm supposed to do, this is what I love to do. And I was like, it just shows that your circumstances are so much based on how you feel about what you're doing and not really about what you're doing. To a lot of other people, your circumstances could seem tough and impossible. To you, it's like, this is the easiest thing in the world. Like, I could not do this. So putting yourself in a circumstance like that and finding that niche for yourself where I don't want to do anything else, I couldn't imagine doing anything else, it makes your life so much less stressful, so much easier. It's become so easy to work hard because it doesn't seem like working hard. You're just doing what you're naturally curious to do. I think that's the biggest piece of advice and a big reason why I switched majors. A big reason why I pursue things on a whim, even though it stresses my family out there, like they can never keep up with what I'm working on. But I think that's the biggest piece for me for sure.
So if you were talking to, let's say you're talking to an incoming college student right now, and they say, hey, Rashad, I'm coming to college, I'm paying all this money, and I almost feel kind of pressured to go into this major, but to be honest, I really don't know like what I want to do. What advice would you have for someone like that?
Yeah, I think taking time, like especially like in like, the best time for me was like during breaks, is I would take time and just like look into all of the options that are really offered. Like you go in with a set of skills and a set of knowledge that you kind of leads you to choose to be certain things in life or to have certain majors in school. But very few of us actually really take time to look at everything that is out there as far as opportunity. And there's never just one thing that each of us can do. Like, I just don't believe that there's one specific thing that we can do and we can't do anything else in the world. A lot of our skills are going to be transferable to other things, and we're going to have skills that we don't even necessarily know we have. So just try stuff. Like, go on a free education website and like look at the classes and see what sounds interesting during your break, or just like look at the possible career potential for like degrees that sound interesting to you. But the worst thing you can do, I think, in my opinion, is start as a major, not like it, get your degree in that major and then have to figure out what you're going to do for the rest of your life, because as important as school is, it's 4 years of your life, but your degree and what you decide to pursue in your life is going to be a lot of your life, and you have the opportunity to change that after you get your degree, but it's going to be difficult because you're going to have security in that degree. And so take the time, even if it takes staying an extra semester, or even if you have to take a semester away from school to figure it out, like do it. I took time off of school and I was working in the campaign. That was the best decision I ever made, and I never regret it, even though I'm not graduating as early as I would have. Like that extra year of time was like paramount to me. It was so important. So just don't worry about it. Don't be pressured to finish in 4 years and know exactly what you're going to do and graduate right away. Like get a degree in something that you want to do, and if you don't want to get a degree, then don't.
Yeah, it's definitely not it's not the finish line, but instead it's more of like a certificate to start what it is you want to do. A question I also had, this is kind of backtracking a little bit, but earlier when we were just talking about data, it's be we're now in a point in time where data has surpassed oil in regards to its value. Like several years ago, it was the biggest companies were the ExxonMobils, the Shell, the BPs, and even today they're still very big companies. Like ExxonMobil, if it was a country, it'd be one of the top 50 richest countries in the world, and that's just a corporation. So if that corporation going down by us switching to renewables, that would create global economic problems. But we're now at a point in time where that's not even the most valuable thing anymore. It's our data. Now you look at the giants and you have tech giants like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, those type of companies. And I want to kind of ask you, do you see data turning into a human right? And if so, what do you think people could start doing to be more informed about how their own data is being used?
It's funny that you brought that up. Before we jumped on here, I tried to save the message. There's just a new Twitter update about their delayed data collection process. I thought it'd be kind of something that's interesting to bring up, so I'm glad you brought it up. I think 1,000% there has to be a limitation on the data that's collected by private companies. And the reason is, if we have the right to privacy in our own homes, 90% of the times, like the data that they're collecting from us is data that we're giving out while we're residents of our own home, while we're just chilling in bed or like scrolling the internet. You look at something on Amazon once, and then from now on, all of your Instagram ads are that one item. Like where it becomes a slippery slope where what is considered data and what isn't considered data, and what is considered an ethical method of collection and what isn't. Is listening in on your home okay? Well, if that's okay, then why can't we survey you? Like if a private company like Facebook or Google has the right to track all of your process, like everything that you're doing throughout the day, then why is that limitation not set on them, but it's set on the government? And is the government going to kind of extend their branches into private entities in order to gather more data? And we've seen some of that where, like, when there's crime, like the government reaches out to private companies in order to gather data that they've collected because the private companies don't have the same restrictions that the government does. Just because the Pentagon can't survey you doesn't mean that Apple can't. And so that's where, like, there becomes like real like human rights issues as far as like they're literally breaking the Constitution with data collection. But how do you, it's you can't see it. It's not like if they were surveying you with a camera, you can see the camera, you can't see them collecting your data. So I think there's gonna have to be legislation. Realistically, I think what it needs to come to is just as there's cabinets for everything else, there's needs to be government cabinets and government portions of legislation specifically based on data, and specifically based on technology and especially artificial intelligence as well, because these are things that are going to be so greatly impacting the communities, but very few of them are going to have the knowledge or the capability to prevent themselves from being harmed. If we see bad legislation passed on taxes, we know how it's going to hurt us for the most part. if we see bad legislation on data, what percentage of the people that are being affected by that legislation are going to know what's happening? And even a smaller percentage are going to be able to do anything about it. So 100% to answer it, it should be a human right. It should be legislated. It should be like monitored and controlled. But how we do that and how we get there is a tough logistical question. I think it's going to take some really forward thinking legislation and community action by people like us to kind of put an end to some of the tracking that's going on.
What was that tweet you were referencing? And I'm going to leave that question. And then I got another follow-up question. But what was that tweet you were referencing? You were saying something about how our data is going to be collected. There's a change to that or something like that?
Yeah. Let me pull it up because is it literally a pop-up when you pull up Twitter? It like says, hey, there's been changes to our data collection process. Sorry if you can hear me.
No, you're good. You're good. So Twitter themselves is changing the process in regards to how they collect data?
Yes, and the weird part about it is like there always has to be a justification from private companies as to why they changed their data collection process. But the explanation was essentially so that they can continue to run as a free free application, which I think we all know that Twitter is far from being in danger of having to like have a cost-based platform. I don't think that their previous data collection method was causing them to be in the red. Like I just don't think that. And so then the real question is like, why? Why are they continuing to change their data collection processes? And especially in terms of how they relay that data to other private companies, because that's where like, you're talking about the value of data. Like, yes, our data is important to Twitter, and it's important to Facebook, and it's important to Google, but it's especially important for those companies to be able to sell that data to other companies, and that's where the value comes from. And so when you're a company I'm just going to like say random clothing companies, it's because it's to everyone, whether you're Nordstrom's or Walmart or Facebook, like having other people's like preferences and data is invaluable. You don't have to worry about marketing. You don't have to worry about any of that because it's all based on algorithm.
If someone came up to you and asked, okay, why does it matter if Facebook or Twitter like knows my gender, the fact that I love talking about basketball or this is that, like if someone said that to you, how would you kind of explain to them? Like, how would you explain to someone why their data is valuable?
Yeah, so I think, so as far as like the maybe the minute details that they may collect, like whether or not you like basketball, no, that specific fact about you may not be an issue, but the issue becomes how was that data collected and how much impact, like how much influence can we have on the way that data is collected? Because if we live in a society where any piece of data can be collected in any way by any entity without our like real knowledge, they give us a 100-page long terms and agreements thing that we're not going to read, and that we, even if we read it, most of us wouldn't understand. And then they say, okay, well, this gives us the right to do all the things we said in there. We essentially become a world where we have no, like very, very limited freedoms as far as our own personal privacy. You'll be scared to own any technology because that technology is going to be used against you. They're just going to use artificial intelligence to survey people through like the technology that they purchase. And it's because there's a slippery slope as far as personal rights, persons that aren't like specifically conveyed in the Constitution become up in the air, and you have the right to privacy unless you sign it away. So if you're signing it away, then you're kind of out of luck. But then if you don't know you sign it away, it becomes a slippery slope. So sure, it may not be a big deal that they know you like basketball, but if everyone knows everything that you've ever done in your entire life and they got that through some shiesty methods, that's an issue. We would never let the police just set up a camera in our home. We would never let the Pentagon come set up a camera in our home and watch everything we're doing, whether we're doing something wrong or not, because we have the right to privacy, because we have the right to our own life and our own space. And
you were letting companies like Facebook and Google do that to us through our phones, and we just haven't necessarily been aware of it.
100%. There's so many like stories about people like never have Googled something. They say it once, and then the next day, all of their ads are that one item. And like, that doesn't seem like a huge deal. Like, it's kind of creepy. But in order for it to have recognized that you said that one thing, it's been listening to everything you've ever said. And I think where it gets even weirder is how that will disproportionately affect certain communities if they start doing surveillance based on technology, because there's just going to be different monitoring. Like, they're just inherently going to monitor different places at different rates. We see it with all sorts of enforcement. Like, things are enforced differently in different places. And it's almost always disproportionately like lower income and communities of color that get hit by things the worst. And I don't think data would be any different. I think that it becomes an issue for everyone, but it especially comes with an issue for certain populations. And unfortunately, those are the populations that would, like, the low income communities are the ones that are less likely to have access to things to prevent themselves from getting in those situations. So,
can you speak on who are the biggest customers for data? Like, who is paying the most money right now to like have our information? Like, because this information is being collected, but it's also being sold.
Yeah, for sure. I think anything, any company that sells anything is purchasing data with like insane return on investment. So any retailer you could possibly think of is collecting data. Amazon is purchasing data and collecting data. I think it starts getting really sick in terms of the value of an individual's data goes up and down based on their likelihood to purchase things. But that includes things like whether or not you have health-related issues, whether or not you have depression, whether or not you are male or female, whether you're old or young. Like, your inherent value and your data's inherent value is based on your tendency to purchase things. If you're sick, a big expense is going to be medicine for you. So your data is going to be worth more because pharmaceutical companies are going to want to purchase it because you're sick, and they want to be able to advertise to you without having to find you on TV. All right, like, they can just literally jump right into your phone. People that have depression are more likely to purchase things because insecurity is a big portion of like people making large purchases on cosmetics, or like the whole weight loss industry is literally just based on feeding on people's insecurities and stuff, like emotions about themselves. So any retailer, anyone that sells anything is collecting data. Governments are collecting data and purchasing data. Every company that has a 21st century like marketing plan is purchasing data.
Now, you mentioned the need of having just a separate branch of government just strictly just for this. We're not there right now. So even though we're not there right now, is there any policy or anything in place that kind of keeps like an organization like Amazon or Facebook kind of in line at all?
Yeah, so obviously there's oversight committees in Congress, and a lot of the times when you see private companies that go through large scandal, they will have to meet with certain like portions of Congress and oversight committees. I think the issue with that is our elected officials, as overall brilliant as a lot of them are, they all come from such different backgrounds. A lot of them are lawyers. A lot of them have very legislative backgrounds, but not necessarily tech backgrounds. And that's where it gets a little tricky, because if you're having people who don't really understand the process keep very, very sophisticated organizations accountable, it becomes difficult. Like, there was a time when Google was in speaking with Congress, and there was somebody asking them with their Apple iPhone if they were getting tracked by Google, like, or I think it was Android, They're asked basically if they were tracking them through their Apple, and we're like, we're a completely separate company. Like, no, we're not listening to your conversation. We're not even that company. And like the congressman just like didn't understand. And so there are ways that they're kind of attempting to keep them accountable, but a lot of the time it just ends up being like Facebook got like a $5 million fine. Like Facebook's not flinching at that. If you give Facebook a fine for collecting data that's worth billions of dollars, like that's not enough. There needs to be legislation on it to give people more freedom and more access to their own rights. But
You're that rich, they can almost just say this is the cost of doing business.
yeah, for sure. Like they will certainly just look at that as a business expense. Like, oh, every year we're gonna have to pay $5 million for this data, but it's giving us over $1 billion a year. So like we're not even gonna bat an eye at it. But like we're gonna go to dinner and celebrate that it was only $5 million afterwards, you know?
Is there any chance we might see Rashad running for office?
I don't think so. I think I am a fairly private person. Like I'm not super active on social media for a lot of reasons. I, as much as I like go out and hang out with friends, like it's a lot of it is just done inherently privately. And I don't think that I would be comfortable like in public office. I think I would much rather be able to influence like people that are running for office and like give them policy suggestions or help their campaigns. I think I can have more impact that way, but I'm never gonna say never. A lot of people that run for office said they'd never run for office and then they end up doing it. So you might just see me run for Congress one day, who knows?
Let me know you got my vote.
You're gonna run for something one day too, don't even try.
Don't know about that,
All right, man. We'll
I was gonna
see.
ask you, so knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Oh man. I would say the point of planning for something is to be able to be flexible within the plan. Younger me was very set in stone on what he thought he wanted to do, and it made the transition a lot harder on himself. It was like a super like life-changing decision for me to switch my major, and it really shouldn't have been that big. There's a lot of like signs early on that I wanted to change, and I just kind of like tried to shift like force myself through it. So I would say it's like this is not like the entire race. The entire race isn't school. And there's no one right path to get to where you want to go. Life can take you 100 different directions, and regardless of what direction it takes you, like at the end of the day, you can grab the steering wheel and orient yourself the way you want to go. So just kind of be patient and make decisions based on what you want to do, not necessarily what you thought you might want to do one day. And everything will kind of work out.
That's some solid advice right there. And then I got one more last question for you. If you could
Okay.
step into my shoes, what would you have asked yourself that I didn't ask you today?
Honestly, I think you asked a lot of really good questions. I think there were some aspects of like people's like specific family dynamics that like kind of influenced how they end up being the way they are. I was like watching I love the interview you did with Uma, and I think it would have been interesting for me to hear a lot of like the specific family dynamics that he thinks may have kind of shaped him. And I think that's important for everyone. I think who your parents are and the way you're raised like has a huge impact on you. And we kind of touched on it a bit, but I think that's always an interesting thing to learn from people.
Definitely. You want to dive into it?
I mean, I can, yeah, sure.
Let's dive into it. So family dynamics, you mentioned particularly your upbringing with a single mother and things like that. I actually did want to ask throughout the interview. I just wasn't sure if it'd be an okay question to ask first, but you saying that is actually perfect because I was intrigued. But just out of curiosity, like what was your upbringing like in regards to just having a single mother and not having, or did you have someone that played that father figure role there for you?
Kind of. I think early on, the whole dynamic with my family is a little bit interesting. I'll just text my dad if I say too much later and he sees it. But my dad was in a relationship with my mom while he was separated but married to someone else. And then him and my mom split up. Basically, like he had kids in a family like before I came around. And so I think that made my situation a little bit different just because my father was like in the same city as me. But a lot of the time I wasn't seeing a ton of him just because he had other obligations. And so I think that like shaped socially a lot of who I am, I think. I took good and bad things.
What do you mean by how it shaped you socially? Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, like just the way that I see my social interactions with people and like who I want to be as a person, not necessarily professionally, but as a human being. A lot of that is shaped based on like the experiences that I went through when I was younger, as far as my family dynamic. I saw the way that people's decisions can affect other people, whether they're intended to or not, whether or not they're with malice or not. Like every decision you make, there's probably someone else on the receiving or giving end of that. And so I think it's important to like kind of be very cautious as far as the impact that you have on people. But I also think it's was a really eye-opening thing as far as the ability of open communication to fix anything. Me and my dad have an excellent relationship now, but that wasn't always the case. And me and my mom has like always been my best friend. Like that will never change. And that's just a factor. It's a result of open communication. Without having tough conversations, you never really get past tough situations. And a lot of those tough conversations led me to like such a blissful place now. But a lot of the positive things that I learned from my dad is he's one of the hardest working people I've ever met in my entire life. Like a little bit of his background, he actually grew up without his dad as well. His dad was killed. And so like he was always like from a position of being of like financial provider. So like that's what he's always done. He's always made sure that his kids like were like in a good place financially. And he dropped out of high school. He had a kid when he was really young. Got his GED, started working when he was really young. Now, like I said, he's the vice president of the union at Quaker Oats. So, like, just an example of how far hard work can get you, no matter what, like the circumstances. And that's something that I for sure try to like learn from him and take from him. But then also from my mom, I take learning to love what you do and doing things because they are special, and doing things because they're important and not necessarily relying on money for your happiness. Teachers don't make a ton of money, but my mom is rich every day. Like she's so wealthy as far as her love of her life every day. Like that's she loves waking up every single day. That's the best thing you could ask for. She loves going to work every day. So like just everything that I've seen around me is kind of what I use to like shape my experiences. Because if you don't learn from that, like what are you gonna learn from?
Yeah. And you mentioned the importance of having those tough conversations. And at the end of the day, like a conversation, simply put, is just a convo. Like it's really just you engaging in that dialogue, but at the same time, there are times where certain dialogue could be so uncomfortable to you that you might be so scared to have and like actually could run away from it. But what advice would you have to people like in situations where they're in need of like a tough dialogue and that like relates maybe their family or like a friend? How would you kind of push someone to engage in that type of dialogue? Because it's
Yeah.
not easy, it's really tough, it can be scary at times.
1,000%. The way all I can really give is my experience on how I approached it. I kind of just sat down with myself and acknowledged the fact that not having the conversation was like the awkwardness and kind of the tension that was there would never go away if I never had it. And as hard as like the 30 to 45 minutes was for us to have the conversation, as hard as that 30 to 45 minutes was, it couldn't be more harmful than having awkwardness and tension every single day for the next 50 years. Like it just didn't equate itself to me. I was gonna have to see my dad constantly. I was gonna be around my dad. I wasn't gonna avoid the rest of my family because there was awkwardness with my family. So it was something that like I knew I had to confront. And in the end, I learned that it was affecting other parts of my life, not just my relationship with my dad. And so, like, the feelings that you have towards these awkward conversations, they carry over. Energy isn't stagnant, like it permeates through all parts of your life. And so, like, some releasing that energy and kind of hashing it out was like life-changing, a life-changing experience, because that's how I approach everything now. Like, if we have something hard, like, let's sit down, let's talk about it. Like, I'm not scared of that anymore. So just know that those tough conversations are gonna lead to like a better way for yourself. You're gonna feel better about that situation, one, but it's gonna make every situation in the future easier as well.
A fact for sure. And yeah, for me, speaking of personal experiences too, I'm just like my own parents have just completed hitting the restart button on life and moved from Sudan to the US and trying to
Crazy.
understand everything and why they did it. But those conversations, yeah, they really do go far away and they do really get you closer to the people you care about. But yeah, those
100%.
conversations can be even easier to have with a stranger than they are with your own parents. It's typically the people you're closest to that
Yeah.
is the hardest.
Yeah. As well, especially because you don't want to like say anything that's gonna like damage the relationship, but if you're both like really wanting to have a good relationship, like you're not gonna be hurt by honesty. Like you're both gonna be able to be honest and be able to get things off your chest and be like, okay, this is where we are, like where do we go?
Did you
I'm
have
sure.
any siblings?
Yeah, so I have four half siblings. So three like of my dad's kids and then one of my mom's kids. So I'm the middle kid. I'm the middle child.
Does having siblings influence you in any way in regards to like maybe how competitive you are or anything like that?
Oh, 100%. I grew up kind of as an only child until I was like 10 because I didn't live with any of my other siblings. And like I didn't really spend much time with them until I was like 13 or 14. But my little brother, for sure, especially today, it's funny because he's like 8 years younger than me, but he is one of the most competitive kids I've ever met. And so I love it because he plays basketball and we just go at it. My older brother, not so much. We just kind of have more of a chill relationship. And then I have two sisters. I'm not super competitive with them. I just give them a hard time. We just bicker. But my little brother, for sure, we love competing in everything, like video games, sports, grades, it doesn't matter. This year I got to pick out his Christmas outfit because I had a bit better GPA than him, so.
That's what's up. What'd you have him wearing?
He hates wearing dress clothes, so I had him dressed up in my dress clothes, so it was like hanging off his feet. He had to wear a size 13 shoe, my big shirt, like it was great. He had to take family pictures of me.
Hilarious.
Yeah, man.
Hey man, just wanted to say thank you again. I really
Yeah.
appreciate you taking the time to do the podcast. I know I'm just getting started, so it really does mean a lot. It's gonna help me get off the ground. So
No, man, it's great. The content's been really good. Episode 10 or so, we're gonna have somebody get on here and interview you because that's the one we're all waiting for. So
right, if that time comes and the people ask for it, I'm gonna pull you up to have to do the interview.
oh man, I shouldn't have said anything.
Hey, you walked into it.
Yeah, I did.
All right, man. Thank you so much, though. We appreciate it.
Yeah, bro. No problem. Thank you for having me.
All right, have a good one.
You as well.
And everybody that was listening, thank you for listening. Really appreciate it. That's a wrap for episode 3. And for the next episode, we're gonna have Austin Thorne to come in for that one.